stories about the hearing the next day. No rational person could view that hearing and react with horror at Joe McCarthy. Democrats do the most outrageous things imaginable, collaborate with totalitarian regimes, commit felonies in the Oval Office, gay-bait Senate staffers, and if anyone complains, they scream about fascist oppression. Through the left's infernal slander techniques, the myth of McCarthyism took flower. In liberal folklore, Welch's tearful response to McCarthy would not be matched until Bill Clinton angrily insisted he would selflessly fight impeachment to vindicate the plain meaning of the Constitution. It simply must be accepted that McCarthy is bad because of liberals' capacity to call him names. One article about the Army-McCarthy hearings say the hearings show McCarthy in all of his demagogic glory. Another portrays McCarthy as the opposite of a bully, saying Welch's verbal dexterity rendered McCarthy a mountain of quaking mute terror. So was he a demagogue or a mass of quaking mute terror? And wasn't inspiring terror a bad thing when McCarthy did it? Liberals can't get their stories straight, which would matter if they were engaged in honest reporting rather than spinning fairy tales. One incident from the Army-McCarthy hearings helps illustrate what liberals mean when they say McCarthy trampled human decency and crushed the human spirit. It occurred when McCarthy refused to reveal his sources. He had produced an outline of a letter from J. Edgar Hoover to the Army, alerting them to communist infiltration at Fort Monmouth. The Democrats could have cared less about communists in the Army. As with Linda Tripp, they simply wanted to prove that the manner by which a Republican had exposed liberals broke some law. Phony, folksy country lawyer Joe Welch demanded that McCarthy reveal his source's name. Far from unreasonable, McCarthy described his source generally as someone with Army intelligence, but refused to give up the name. As McCarthy correctly said, no government whistleblower would ever step forward if his confidence could not be kept. Liberals were indignant that McCarthy insisted on protecting his sources. They could not believe McCarthy would stubbornly refuse to back down in the face of their hysterics. Conservatives are required to lose an argument on purpose whenever some liberal starts sniffling. It's their obligation to let liberals have the last word. Otherwise, the conservative is being arch and cruel. These courageous liberals, with their voices of principle, were outraged that McCarthy refused to divulge a whistleblower's name. While feverishly assembling a blue-ribbon Senate committee to investigate whether David Shine wore a fur-lined cap, Democrats were indignant that McCarthy insisted on investigating Soviet espionage in the highest reaches of government. Their passion of hate for McCarthy had only one cause, candidly explained by Hubert Humphrey. McCarthy's real threat to American democracy was the fact that he has immobilized the liberal movement. So they created a hobgoblin for the masses to fear. The New York Times campaigned viciously against McCarthy. The Senate was constantly investigating him. The elites turned every communist named by McCarthy into a national hero. They finally killed him with 1,000 cuts. In 1954, when liberal loathing of McCarthy had reached a fever pitch, CBS ran a vicious, deceptive hatchet piece on him viewed by millions of Americans. It was hosted by Edward R. Murrow, friend of Soviet spy Lawrence Dugan. Other organs of establishmentarian treason followed suit. The Senate voted to hold hearings on a censure resolution against McCarthy. Among the grounds being considered for censure were McCarthy's remarks about Senator Ralph Flanders. In a fire-breathing diatribe on the Senate floor, Flanders had called McCarthy a homosexual and compared him to Hitler. In response, McCarthy said, "I think they should get a man with a net and take him to a good quiet place." For this, the Democrats thought McCarthy should be censured. It is intemperate for Republicans to respond to vicious abuse by Democrats. Senators were free to defame and abuse McCarthy, but it was considered a grave violation of the dignity of the Senate if he criticized them back. McCarthy called one of his inquisitors, Senator Robert Hendrickson, a living miracle, the only man in the world who had lived so long with neither brains nor guts. For statements made in defiance of two Senate committees investigating him, McCarthy was censured by a body that, 50 years later, would do nothing about a president who committed felonies to obstruct a sexual harassment lawsuit. Here's the story of Joe McCarthy you won't read in the history books. This version will be unfamiliar to most Americans inasmuch as it includes facts. Joe McCarthy was an extraordinarily bright Irish farm boy who rose from humble origins in Wisconsin to become one of the most admired politicians of his day. After becoming the first member of his family to graduate from high school, he went on to college and law school. Just 4 years out of law school, McCarthy made headlines by becoming the youngest ever Wisconsin Circuit Court judge. When war came, he volunteered for the Marines, leaving his judgeship behind. After returning from the war, he ran for the United States Senate. He won, becoming the youngest man to serve in the U.S. Senate and also the Senate's first World War II veteran. McCarthy had begun his political career as a Democrat, but quickly realized the Democratic Party was a rotten organization, so while still in his 20s, he left the party of corrupt big city machines and segregation. After a few years in Washington, McCarthy married Jean Kerr, a ravishing beauty far above him in social class. Kerr had been voted the most beautiful woman at George Washington University and was a bridesmaid at Margaret Truman's wedding. More unyielding and anti-communist than even McCarthy, Kerr became his chief of staff. McCarthy supported civil rights for blacks and campaigned as fervently in black neighborhoods as he did in white neighborhoods. Long before it was fashionable, he employed a strikingly diverse staff, women, gays, and Jews. Unlike the segregationist Democrats who opposed him, McCarthy was famously colorblind, religion blind, gender blind, sexual orientation blind. He just thought Soviet agents shouldn't be working in the code room of the Pentagon. Progressive liberals took sadistic pleasure in gay-baiting him for having homosexuals on his staff. Segregationist Democrats attacked McCarthy with blind ferocity. Among the segregationists against McCarthy was Bill Clinton's mentor, Senator Fulbright, whom McCarthy called Senator Halfbright so often that, as Fulbright complained, people were starting to believe it. McCarthy was such a congenial fellow that, despite these taunts, Fulbright once remarked that he couldn't help but to like the SOB. Many others before McCarthy had tried to make an issue of the Democrats' outrageous blindness to Soviet subversion. Only McCarthy succeeded. All organs of elite opinion tenaciously opposed McCarthy. And yet somehow, no matter how bellicose their slanders, McCarthy's popularity continued to skyrocket. By January 1953, liberal columnist Jack Anderson sadly admitted, "We had used up almost our entire bag of tricks against McCarthy without marked effect." But the wolf pack had caught the scent. The media would not relent. The unending attacks finally wore McCarthy down. Most painfully for him, the attacks wore down his supporters. The cheering crowds and widespread support he had enjoyed through so many battles began to evaporate. As Roy Cohn said, he had taken more punishment than a normal man could be expected to absorb. Never have so much vituperation and defamation been directed toward a person in public life. At the age of 48, McCarthy died broken and defamed. The New York Times did not mention McCarthy's death in an editorial out of pure hatred. Times editor Charles Mertz said, "Why dignify the bastard? Let him pass from the scene without more attention." Weeks before he died, McCarthy exclaimed at Easter dinner, "They're murdering me, they're killing me." That's what they do. The left's enthusiasm for destroying individual lives still sputters to life occasionally, driving their monumental crusades against Newt Gingrich, Ken Starr, and Linda Tripp. Frustrated in their attempts to enslave the world, destroying individuals is the only fun liberals have anymore. Contrary to today's image of McCarthy as a despised Torquemada, McCarthy was given a rare state funeral with a private memorial service in the Senate chamber, his seat covered with flowers. St. Matthew's Cathedral bestowed him with the highest honor the Catholic Church can confer, performing a solemn pontifical requiem mass before 100 priests and 2,000 well-wishers. 70 senators attended his funeral, as did J. Edgar Hoover. 30,000 Americans lined up outside the Washington Funeral Home where McCarthy lay to pay their final respects from early in the morning until late at night. Condolences poured into McCarthy's wife over the next few days, amounting to over 70 bags of mail. Maybe it would have been better if McCarthy had been more measured in his rhetoric. And maybe it would have been better if Ken Starr had the savoir-faire of Cary Grant, and Linda Tripp looked like Gwyneth Paltrow, and Monica was perfect. But were there Soviet spies in the State Department? Chapter 7. Vietnam. Oh, how they miss Saigon. In the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attack, the nation's editorial pages virtually transformed themselves into Vietnam War updates. Vietnam is the left's favorite war because America lost. Liberals never tire of citing it. Enragingly, liberals talk about Vietnam as if it proves something about the use of force generally, rather than the Democrats' own bungling incompetence in military affairs. Historical accounts of the Vietnam War are incomprehensible because liberals refuse to admit the failure of their own national security strategy. The only important lesson from the Vietnam War is this: Democrats lose wars. Republicans proceed from the assumption of America's virtue. Democrats do not. Consequently, they are squeamish about any projection of U.S. power in the national interest. Vietnam is merely a part of a great heritage of Democratic foreign policy disasters. President Kennedy allowed brave Cubans to invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs and then double-crossed them at the last minute by refusing to provide air cover. Because of President Kennedy's failure of nerve, thousands of Cuban liberators were slaughtered or imprisoned by Castro. But at least America didn't look like a cowboy. Kennedy's failure of will at the Bay of Pigs made a greater confrontation with the Soviet Union inevitable. In short order, Khrushchev built the Berlin Wall and sent nukes to Cuba, nearly leading to World War III. The Russians would never have dared to take advantage of Nixon by delivering nuclear missiles to Cuba, but even stupid people are cunning enough to smell cowardice, and Kennedy had just backed down from a confrontation with a tinpot dictator. Liberals hail Kennedy as a hero for being able to navigate his way out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, neglecting to mention that it was a crisis of his own making. Time and again, Democrats' gutless pusillanimity has emboldened America's enemies and terrified its allies. President Carter allowed Americans to be held by Iranian savages for 444 days. He ordered a poorly conceived rescue attempt that crashed a helicopter in the desert and killed six brave members of the Delta Force. In the war on terrorism, Democrats purported to oppose military action against Iraq if anyone in the military might get hurt. But they don't mind inept commanders-in-chief who dishonor the military by ordering suicide missions. In another show of America's force in the world, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Carter responded by boycotting the Olympics. And thus was a fearsome blow struck at little 14-year-old American girls who had spent their lives training for the Olympics. In the great Democratic tradition of taking the nation to war without a plan to win, only the Democrats could have produced Vietnam. The Democrats' miserable prosecution of that war has tended to overshadow that it was, as Ronald Reagan said, a noble cause. It is also a textbook case of how Democratic equivocation about the use of American power leads to catastrophe. Republican confidence and determination in waging war does not preclude occasional missteps and errors, but in the end, they win the war. Democrat presidents are the opposite. Battles are won, but somehow Democrats always manage to wrest defeat from the jaws of victory. When media darling President Kennedy first sent troops to Vietnam, liberals thought he was a genius. Having already demonstrated his daring do at the Bay of Pigs by losing a scuffle with a banana boat despot, Kennedy sought to prove America could win someplace in the world. After the North Vietnamese had attacked our ally, the South Vietnamese, both the New York Times and the Washington Post thought war with Vietnam was a splendid idea. But soon the media would make the startling discovery that war is hell. War is especially hell when we lose, and we will always lose when the commander-in-chief is an irresolute Democrat. For some reason, that connection has eluded liberals to this day. No air cover Kennedy committed American troops to Vietnam, but he didn't want to be too tough with the enemy. When the U.S. could have easily won, Kennedy refused to order an invasion of the North. Soon, President Kennedy was consumed with doubts about our ally. Democrats spend a lot of time being consumed by doubts about our allies. Much as liberals would one day attack the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan for not being a band of Thomas Jefferson clones, Kennedy decided the South Vietnamese premier, Ngo Dinh Diem, had his shortcomings. As allies go, there was nothing the matter with Diem, especially compared to Ho Chi Minh, or the Vietnamese George Washington, as liberals called our enemy. In classic Democrat fashion, Kennedy couldn't stay focused on the enemy. In the middle of a war, Kennedy dispatched the CIA to help assassinate our own ally. President Lyndon Johnson, who inherited the war when Kennedy was assassinated, principally viewed the Vietnam War as a method of proving the Democrats could be trusted with foreign policy, which they cannot. Historian David Halberstam writes that Johnson would talk to his closest political aides about the McCarthy days, of how Truman lost China, and then the Congress and the White House, and how, by God, Johnson was not going to be the president who lost Vietnam and then the Congress and the White House. The military advised Johnson that war was winnable in Vietnam, but it would require overwhelming force. Here was a novel idea for a Democrat: provide enough force to win. It was something the Democrats have been incapable of since Harry Truman. Consequently, Johnson demurred. He micromanaged the bombing from the Oval Office and insisted on only a limited bombing campaign. He chose targets out of political calculation rather than strategic necessity. Johnson's refusal to pursue victory in Vietnam is attributed to his widely heralded moral qualms. His pain was apparently lessened by allowing American servicemen to die while not allowing them to win. American lives were sacrificed on the altar of this hand-wringing Hamlet's much-touted moral conscience. Johnson's pain at U.S. casualties was not so great as to distract him from his real love, creating comically useless federal welfare programs. In the middle of the Vietnam War, for the first time in U.S. history, welfare spending would exceed defense spending. Johnson's inability to wage a war warmed the heart of the domestic peace movement, which was unabashedly rooting for the Viet Cong. Rolling out all the usual arguments for treason, liberals said the conflict in Vietnam was a civil war, the communists were really agrarian reformers, the way to fight communism is to send money to end PID, poverty, ignorance, and disease. The traitor lobby was ascendant and very loud. The media did its part too, sowing fear and trying to undermine patriotism. Eager to demoralize the nation, the press happily published staged photos of alleged American atrocities. Enemy defeats were characterized as victories, such as the Viet Cong's failed Tet Offensive. The New York Times style book required the word unwinnable be used in any sentence about the war. But despite the left's relentless effort to dishearten the nation, vast majorities of Americans consistently supported the war. The myth that an anti-war movement swept the nation is preposterous. Right up until our imminent withdrawal from Vietnam, no more than 20% of Americans ever opposed the war in Vietnam. Contrary to hagiographic descriptions of youthful onerness smoking pot and listening to the White Album in their Berkeley dorm rooms, even the worst generation wasn't so bad after all. The under-35 crowd supported the Vietnam War more than those over 35. Support for war was strongest among young white males. Because of his inept handling of the Vietnam War, President Johnson's re-election campaign was over before it began. After an embarrassing showing in the New Hampshire primary, he withdrew from the race. Voters opposed him by a 2-to-1 ratio for not being sufficiently hawkish in Vietnam. President Nixon came into office and made the best of a bad situation. Within 4 years, he had nearly snatched victory from the Democrats' defeat. Nixon withdrew over 500,000 troops from Vietnam, leaving a trim 20,000 troop force behind. He cut spending on the war by over 80%. With a fraction of the military and economic aid provided under the Johnson administration, Nixon kept the communist North Vietnamese at bay and protected freedom in South Vietnam by relentlessly bombing the North. Nixon had been elected in part based on his promise to end the war honorably. He would have done so, too, but for Democrats in Congress. In January 1973, the Nixon administration negotiated a truce between Hanoi and Saigon, known as the Paris Peace Accords. The war was over and our ally would be safe, as long as the agreement was enforced. The U.S. retained 3 trump cards to play if the Communist North violated the truce and invaded South Vietnam. Keep Haiphong Harbor mined, furnish military and economic aid to South Vietnam, or resume the bombing. In the most dishonorable chapter of the nation's history, the Democratic Congress led the United States to double-cross an ally. Using hysteria over Watergate as cover, congressional Democrats openly turned their back on the South Vietnamese, leading to a total communist conquest of Indochina. In August 1973, the height of liberal frenzy over Watergate, Congress demanded that the president seek their approval before resuming any bombing in Vietnam. Within a matter of months, North Vietnam invaded the South. Congressional Democrats refused to appropriate any aid for South Vietnam. Still, with no U.S. support, the South Vietnamese valiantly held off the North for well over a year. But by 1975, the situation was desperate. Even President Gerald Ford, as weak a Republican as there ever was, repeatedly pleaded with the Democratic Congress not to turn its back on our ally, the South Vietnamese. Ford said, "American unwillingness to provide adequate assistance to allies fighting for their lives could seriously affect our credibility throughout the world as an ally." Congress didn't have to send troops, just aid. The Democrats ignored Ford's pleas and abandoned the South Vietnamese. Before the year was out, North Vietnamese tanks rolled into Saigon. In a triumph of liberal foreign policy, Marine helicopters had to be dispatched to airlift American officials and a few fortunate Vietnamese from the roof of the American embassy in Saigon. It was, historian Paul Johnson writes, the gravest and most humiliating defeat in American history. The Democrats did that. They said they were for peace. This is what they produced. Re-education camps, political prisoners, and bloodbaths as communists swept through Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. In Cambodia, millions were slaughtered by Marxist ideologues. Cambodians were forced to watch as family members were decapitated or garroted. Students were made to hang their own teachers. In Laos, an astonishing 10% of the population fled the communist regime. In Vietnam, hundreds of thousands of people were imprisoned for re-education. Hundreds of thousands more died trying to escape their communist slave masters on boats. In a classic statement of liberal patriotism, then New York Times publisher Punch Sulzberger had said in 1964, "I am not sure that what we offer the Vietnamese peasant is any better than what the communists offer." A few years after that, he asked his son, Pinch Sulzberger, the current publisher of the New York Times, whom he would want to see shot if an American soldier came face to face with a North Vietnamese soldier. "I would want to see the American guy get shot," Pinch said. "It's the other guy's country." Since the communists took control, 2 million Vietnamese have tried to flee their country. The exodus of Vietnamese boat people was so massive, it created an international humanitarian crisis. As we have come to expect, the United Nations provided crucial help. The UN's idea was to send them back. The party that willingly abandoned an ally in Vietnam should have never been allowed near the Oval Office again. But instead of hanging their heads in shame, Democrats cite their own inept handling of foreign policy to argue that America should be paralyzed in the face of dangerous despots. "We were barely 3 weeks into the war in Afghanistan when liberals started comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam with a little too much zeal. Their point was, we were going to lose. If we had taken all of Afghanistan in 3 weeks, they would have said it was too fast. That's what liberals said after Reagan's invasion of Grenada. That wasn't a war, it only took a weekend. But 3 weeks in Afghanistan, and they were already complaining we hadn't won yet. So now it's official. Liberals have exactly 3 weeks' worth of blood, sweat, and tears." They clamored for America to be defeated, caterwauling about the ferocious Afghan fighters and proclaiming Afghanistan a Vietnam-style quagmire. From the traitor lobby's Women's Auxiliary, syndicated columnist Molly Ivins wrote on November 1, 2001, "It now looks, with 2020 hindsight, as though we should have taken a few more deep breaths before smacking that tar baby that is Afghanistan. Confident we were getting bogged down in Afghanistan," Times columnist Maureen Dowd sneered at Bush. "Polo at Yale is a bit different than the Afghan version." She said, "The Taliban have the psychological edge on three fronts, military, propaganda, and bioterror." Yes, the Taliban had us right where they wanted us. About a week later, our forces had taken Kabul. By November 15th, the Taliban had fled from 80% of Afghanistan. So much for the quagmire. A week after Kabul fell, the cover story on the Times Week in Review section was titled, "Surprise, War Works After All." This came as a surprise to precisely no one except the New York Times. After America's surprise victory in Afghanistan, liberals began desperately trying to regroup and claim that they were too for the war, with scant evidence to support that claim. Maureen Dowd wrote, "Many who came of age during the Vietnam War, wincing at America's overweening military stance in the world, are now surprised to find themselves lustily rooting for the overwhelming display of force against the Taliban." In the Times news pages, Johnny Apple was still sanguine about the prospects for defeat. As the American-led forces swept through all of Afghanistan, R.W. Apple said, "That made a lot of people think once more about Vietnam. It was becoming clearer and clearer that we could have won Vietnam, too." In an editorial after Bush's post-9/11 State of the Union address, the New York Times nervously warned that America's unrivaled military force must be used sparingly and wisely. It seems that Bush's strategy of power and intimidation against America's enemies reminded the Times of Vietnam. All uses of American military might remind liberals of Vietnam. In adducing proof for the likely success of war with Iraq, Reagan's invasion of Grenada was surely more relevant than Vietnam. Grenada showed the value of Republican resolve to use military force, even when unpopular with hysterical liberal elites. The Gulf War was the most germane comparison, involving virtually the same adversaries only 10 years apart. Yet from the 9/11 terrorist attacks to the end of 2002, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post mentioned Vietnam almost as often as they mentioned the Gulf War. Meanwhile, Reagan's triumphant Grenada invasion was barely mentioned at all. In the fall of 2001, weeks before American and Afghan liberators swept through almost all of Afghanistan, Berkeley professor and journalist Mark Danner wrote an upbeat piece in the Los Angeles Times predicting America's defeat. Hoping to erode the nation's resolve, Danner reminded Americans why they ought to be demoralized and frightened. He said American foreign policy was a story of bluster and flight and uneasy forgetting. To prove it, he cited the following examples: the Bay of Pigs, Vietnam, the Iranian hostage crisis, the flight from Beirut after the American Embassy and Marine Barracks bombings in 1983, and the abandonment of Mogadishu, Somalia, after the death of 18 American servicemen in 1993. It was a list to strike fear in the heart of any American. Fortunately, President Bush was not a Democrat. Apart from the withdrawal of troops from Lebanon, all these foreign policy debacles occurred under Democrats. Even Lebanon was a Democrat policy. Soon after American barracks were bombed, Democrats in Congress set to work drafting a joint resolution demanding that Reagan pull the Marines out of Beirut. Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, supported retreat, explaining that "we must not lose sight of the fact that the Lebanese problem cannot be solved by itself, but must be tackled in the context of a wider accommodation between Syria and Israel, which the United States should actively mediate." In accordance with their party's preemptive surrender policy, all seven Democratic presidential candidates urged that our troops be removed from Lebanon. Senator Joe Biden called for immediate withdrawal of the troops. He said, "There is no longer anything remotely approaching a bipartisan consensus to let the Marines stay for 18 months. The Democratic House Speaker, Tip O'Neill, said the Lebanon policy had failed. The Marines don't know why they're there, and the American people don't know why they're there. Reagan responded to the Democrats' hysteria, saying House Speaker O'Neill may be ready to surrender, but I'm not. He warned that the Democrats' resolution would aid and abet our enemies in the region. He sent Lawrence Eagleburger, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, to tell the faint-hearted congressional Democrats that walking away from Lebanon only postpones the day of reckoning." According to the New York Times, the Democrats postponed their withdrawal resolution in part because of the criticism expressed by Republicans throughout the day. But the Democrats had leapt on the bombing of the Marine barracks as a political issue and would not let go. Though Reagan claimed he wasn't going to pay any attention to the Democrats' carping, unfortunately he did. Reagan gradually withdrew our troops while bombing Syrian-controlled areas that were firing into Beirut and on our troops. The Democrats complained about that, too. They had voted for deploying American troops to Lebanon, but claimed to have no idea that this meant American forces were authorized to shoot back. Speaker O'Neill denounced Reagan's policy of shelling Syrian artillery positions, saying the bombing was absolutely not within the authorization Congress granted to the president under the Lebanon War Powers Resolution. In light of Reagan's spectacular execution of foreign policy, prevailing over an evil empire to win a half-century war with the USSR, to complain that he did not also defy the Democrats in an election year and retaliate more forcefully in Lebanon is like the complaint that the framers of the Constitution, after defeating the British Empire and creating the greatest government ever known to mankind, did not also give women the right to vote. Reagan had bigger fish to fry in the 1980s. He invaded Grenada. He bombed Libya. His administration nourished a long internecine war with a lot of casualties between Iran and Iraq. He gave Israel plenty of aid and a long leash to combat Islamic crazies. All this while winning a final victory over Soviet totalitarianism. By contrast, American failure was the centerpiece of the Johnson, Kennedy, and Carter administrations. Where on the globe was President Johnson winning a war for America while losing one in Vietnam? It's interesting how, in their endless reminiscing about Vietnam, the Iranian hostage crisis, or Black Hawk Down, liberals tend to shy away from mentioning who was president. Liberals treat a war started by Kennedy, lost by Johnson, and nearly ended honorably by Nixon as a Republican war. Here's a little secret academics may not have mastered in their exhaustive study of U.S. history. 49 states re-elected Nixon in 1972. It wasn't because they thought he was doing a lousy job in Vietnam. Nor, despite endless reminders of Vietnam, were Americans feeling particularly frustrated and vulnerable in the war on terrorism. Mark Danner insisted that America was at a grave disadvantage because the enemy had attacked the vulnerability in the American mind. He said the terrorists who gave their lives on September 11th and those who sent them have precise objectives and a clear plan to achieve them. Meanwhile, he said, America was beset by the frustrations of the powerful. Danner explained that beating al-Qaeda would require much greater power than America has shown itself to possess. Except that, oops, wrong again. Outside of the nation's faculty lounges and editorial boards, the vulnerability in the American mind never materialized. Americans were so committed to the war in Afghanistan that even the Democrats could pony up only a single vote in Congress against it. Repeatedly throughout the next year, large majorities of Americans would tell pollsters they also supported attacking Iraq. Every obstructionist objection the Democrats raised to the war on terrorism would instantly vanish through lack of popular support. For 50 years, America's foreign policy failures can be traced to one simple problem. Democrats can't handle foreign policy. You could almost forgive the Democrats for their spectacular record of failure in foreign policy. But then they have the audacity to cite their own derelict handling of the military to argue that it's always a fool's errand to deploy troops in defense of the nation. Remember Vietnam? We should remember Vietnam. This is what we should remember. Whenever Democrats dabble in military affairs, America suffers relentless defeats, entire continents fall to communism, America loses wars, invasions fail, Americans are taken hostage, American soldiers are dragged through the streets of Somalia, and the nation is demoralized and humiliated. It is a fact that the Democrats have been responsible for every unmitigated foreign policy disaster since World War II. Chapter 8. How Truman Won the Cold War During the Reagan Administration. Liberals dispute that Ronald Reagan won the Cold War on the basis of their capacity to put mocking quotation marks around the word "won." That's pretty much the full argument. Restate a factual proposition with sneering quote marks. It used to be evil empire that took the derisive punctuation. But after Reagan vanquished the evil empire, it's one that gets the quotes. Sometimes the whole phrase is put in quote marks, won the Cold War. This is meant to prove not only that no one won, but that there was no war. Ironically, though there was no Cold War and nobody won, the true hero of the Cold War is Harry Truman. It was the process of containment set in motion by reliable old Dean Acheson that just needed time to work. Or at least it was someone, anyone, other than Reagan, who won the Cold War. Thus, liberals insist that the true heroes of the Cold War are various great Democratic presidents, such as Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, and Jimmy Carter. Truman is the Democrats' first choice for the true hero of the Cold War, only because of their supreme confidence that no one remembers the Truman administration. Giving the Truman administration credit for standing up to communism is like giving Clinton credit for welfare reform. Truman supported fighting communism and Clinton reforming welfare at the precise instant and not a moment sooner that Americans put a gun to his head and forced him to take a stand. Until the earth-shattering Republican landslide of 1946, Democrats didn't even pretend to be anti-communist. In the seminal 1946 election, the Republicans took both houses of Congress by linking the spread of global communism to the policies of Presidents Roosevelt and Truman. With the slogan, "Had enough?", the nearly moribund Republican Party swept both houses of Congress. It was a more startling upset than the Republican Revolution of 1994 would be some 48 years later. It was only in response to this extraordinary electoral event that the Democratic Party began to dump its popular front element. The 1947 Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and the policy of containment, also known as a substitute for victory, was Democrat track covering. As even David Halberstam admits in his book, The 50s, it had come about under pressure from the right. Only after the 1946 election was anti-communism picked up by the incumbent Democrats. Truman's natural instinct toward Stalin was goo-goo-minded liberalism. After cheerfully carving up Germany with Stalin at the Potsdam Conference in 1946, President Truman told Henry Wallace, "Stalin was a fine man who wanted to do the right thing." At the Nuremberg trials, Truman connived with Stalin to cover up Soviet war crimes and flushed the Hitler-Stalin pact down the memory hole. Most breathtakingly, in March 1946, Truman ostentatiously rebuffed Winston Churchill after his famous Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri. Truman apologized to Stalin and invited him to the United States for a rebuttal speech. He graciously offered the mass murderer the services of USS Missouri for the trip. Paradoxically, much of this is recounted in a book about the Cold War titled Architects of Victory, which hails Truman as one of those architects. Whether the dictator is Joseph Stalin or Saddam Hussein, Democrats always warm to the idea of appeasing murderous dictators. Even after the Republican landslide of 1946, inspiring a major change in Truman's foreign policy, as historian David Halberstam puts it, the Democrats' newfound anti-communism was based more in internationalism than in principled anti-communism. These sniffing panty waists were more loyal to the well-heeled internationalist elite than they were to ordinary Americans. When Truman created the Loyalty Security Program in 1947, he openly admitted to his friends that he had done it only to take the play away from anti-communist Republicans, whom he called the animals. An article in Foreign Affairs described Acheson's dismay at having to play into the hands of the anti-communist primitives, but said he believed the Democrats' pretend anti-communism was useful for domestic political purposes. The term primitives has popped up repeatedly throughout the years. It refers to Americans who express an unseemly enthusiasm for defeating America's enemies. It was not until the War on Terrorism that liberals' use of primitive as an epithet for right-wingers finally fell out of fashion, presumably in deference to the feelings of an enemy that travels by camel. Eventually, Truman responded to the public's anger with Democrat intransigence on communist subversion with hysterical overreaction typical of Democrats. In 1948, Truman's Justice Department began prosecuting Communist Party leaders for sedition under the Alien Registration Act. The law was later thrown out by the Supreme Court. At least he didn't put them in Japanese internment camps, another brilliant Democrat idea. Curiously, Democrats cheerfully cite Truman's doctrine of containment as if it were an aggressive, hawkish stance. At the time, it wasn't viewed that way. To the contrary, conservatives ridiculed the idea of containment, preferring the idea of victory. Nixon called it the Dean Acheson College for Cowardly Containment of Communism. The theory of containment sounded a bit rougher in theory than it was in practice. By 1950, Truman's sly strategy of containment had led to communist takeovers of all of Eastern Europe and over a billion people in China. Truman's defenders hail his abandonment of Chiang Kai-shek without hesitation by proudly boasting that the decision avoided a bloody and futile war and has made the recent improvement of Sino-American relations possible. So by not opposing a communist takeover, Truman helped pave the way to warm relations with the resulting communist dictatorship, and the only downside was that China was then a communist dictatorship. Even after explaining how losing China was a brilliant tactical maneuver on Truman's part, liberals denounce anyone who says Truman lost China. In one of the great moments of American statesmanship, in January 1950, Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, gave a speech at the National Press Club writing off South Korea. He excluded South Korea from America's defensive perimeter, saying, quote, "It must be clear that no person can guarantee these areas against military attack." The speech made quite an impression on Stalin. With his blessing, North Korea attacked South Korea just 5 months later. But don't call them Democrat wars. It could have happened to anyone. As the whole liberal establishment was busily formulating containment and equilibrium doctrines that preached not victory but stalemate, General Douglas MacArthur was turning the Korean War from a devastating defeat to a glorious victory. His troops swept north, eventually crossing the Yalu River, when the Chinese communists attacked. MacArthur responded by ordering the Chinese off the peninsula. Truman was terrified at the show of manly force. It upset the delicate diplomatic steps he had been engaged in to appease the Red Chinese. Truman believed MacArthur's crossing of the Yalu River had unnecessarily antagonized the peace-loving Chinese communists and dragged them into the Korean War. Like everything else Democrats ever believed about communist motives and objectives, subsequently released documents have proved Truman wrong. The Chinese always planned to get into the Korean War. They were waiting for MacArthur to cross the Yalu River for strategic reasons only. As one of Mao's generals said, "To hook a big fish, you must first let the fish taste your bait." Truman began placing political constraints on MacArthur's military strategy. Foreshadowing the Democrats' traitorous execution of the Vietnam War, military strategy was overridden from Washington based on Truman's overriding goal of not upsetting the Red Chinese. MacArthur complained publicly that he was not being allowed to win the war. So Truman fired him for insubordinately fighting the Korean War to win. Americans erupted in fury at MacArthur's firing. Already disgusted by Truman's policy of retreat, effigies of Truman burned all over the country. The International Longshoremen's Union held a work stoppage to protest MacArthur's dismissal. When MacArthur arrived at the San Francisco airport, 500,000 people lined the streets from the airport to the city to cheer the returning hero. 7 million people turned out for a ticker tape parade in MacArthur's honor in New York City. Twice as many as had come out for Dwight Eisenhower after his return from Europe after World War II. Gallup polls showed 66% of the nation opposed to MacArthur's firing. Republicans invited MacArthur to address a joint session of Congress. Many called for Truman's impeachment. Senator McCarthy took a dim view of MacArthur for his showboating, but a dimmer view of Truman's decision to fire a general for winning a war, saying Truman had hatched the idea in a midnight bourbon and Benedictine session. Only by the media's unyielding assertion that Truman was an aggressive anti-communist have people come to believe it. But as it was happening, Americans who were also present at the creation, as Dean Acheson pompously titled his autobiography, were not exactly bowled over by Truman and Acheson's anti-communism. The esteemed political philosopher Sidney Hook described the Truman administration's foreign policy salons as men of mediocre intelligence or the most extraordinary ignorance of the nature of the international communist movement, an ignorance, sad to say, accentuated by stubbornness in refusing to admit that any errors have been made. The 1952 presidential election would finally end the Democrats' 20-year lock on the White House when General Dwight Eisenhower was elected president. In the last patriotic act of either newspaper, the Washington Post and the New York Times endorsed Eisenhower. The left's whitewash of history worked so well that, in the war on terrorism 50 years later, liberals were openly proposing that President Bush follow President Truman's example. In a panic that America might defend itself, Thomas Mann of the Liberal Brookings Institute wrote in the New York Times in October 2002, "Is George W. Bush another Harry S. Truman? He and we should surely hope so." If Bush were another Truman, the entire continents of Africa and Europe would be under Islamic rule by the year 2007. Mann went on to describe Truman masterfully handling foreign policy during the Cold War. Truman's consultations with Congress on national security matters were early, continuous, and substantive. As we have seen, these consultations consisted mostly of Truman's pretending to oppose communism in order to quell the animals. Tellingly, Mann also commended Truman for taking the long view. Liberals are very big on taking the long view when evaluating their foreign policies. They create horrendous foreign policy disasters, but then eventually a Republican is elected president and cleans up the mess. They said containment would work, and lo and behold, 40 years later, right at the end of the Reagan administration, the Soviet Union was stopped dead in its tracks. That's taking the long view. Praise God, President Bush is not another Harry Truman. To review the record, as part of Truman's yeoman work on the Cold War, he cooperated with the Soviets at the Nuremberg trials, whitewashing their joint aggression with Hitler under the Nazi-Soviet pact. He looked the other way when the Soviet Union murdered 3 million Russian prisoners of war returned home by the Allies. On his watch, the Soviet army consolidated its control over Eastern Europe, China became a communist dictatorship, and tens of millions of people were murdered under communist tyrannies. Truman defended communist spy Alger Hiss as a patriot who was framed by Republicans, and his administration tried to indict Whitaker Chambers for perjury. He refused to remove members of his administration identified to him by J. Edgar Hoover and others as communist agents. Truman was considered such a dupe of the communists that the army refused to tell him about the Venona Project. And that's how Truman won the Cold War. We should, of course, be duly grateful to other American presidents for their feeble and impotent public statements in opposition to Soviet expansionism, except Jimmy Carter, who was not remotely opposed. But in terms of actual results, no other American president so much as won a scuffle in the Cold War. Simply in terms of territory lost, here's how other American presidents were waging the Cold War until Reagan. See if you detect a pattern. Under President Woodrow Wilson, the October Revolution brought the communists to power in Russia. The Soviet Union quickly seized Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia and starved about 5 million people to death. Under President Calvin Coolidge, the Soviets added Mongolia, Turkmenia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan to their empire. Under President Herbert Hoover, the Soviets captured no new countries, but did starve another 5 to 15 million people within the Soviet Republic, leading Lady Astor to ask Stalin in 1931, "When are you going to stop killing people?" In his first diplomatic act of office, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt officially recognized the Soviet Union, and the Soviets took Eastern Poland, Moldavia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Albania. Uncle Joe murdered an estimated 12 to 20 million people and forced at least 10 million into slave labor. Under President Truman, we lost China, the most populous nation on Earth. The Red Chinese occupied Tibet. Over the next 4 decades, Chinese communists would murder between 34 million and 64 million Chinese, as well as an estimated 1 million Tibetans. On his watch, the Soviets consolidated their control over Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Eastern Germany to the Elba River, Yugoslavia, and North Korea to the 38th parallel. He started the Korean War when the Soviet-backed North Koreans attacked South Korea. Ho Chi Minh announced communism in Vietnam. Stalin had nearly 100 million people under his rule. Under President Dwight Eisenhower, the Korean War was concluded with a truce, holding the communist North Koreans at the 38th parallel. Cuba fell to communism under Fidel Castro, establishing the first Soviet-backed communist regime in the Western Hemisphere. the communist Viet Cong instigated a violent insurrection to conquer South Vietnam. The Red Army crushed a popular uprising in Hungary in 1956, and the U.S. refused to intervene. In 1956, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev warned visiting ambassadors from the West, "We will bury you." Under President John F. Kennedy, in just 2 short years, the U.S. was humiliated in the Bay of Pigs incident, lost a standoff with the Soviet Union resulting in U.S. missiles being pulled out of Turkey, and began the Vietnam War to ill effect. The USSR also beat the United States in space, sending the first man into orbit. East Germany erected the Berlin Wall. Under Lyndon B. Johnson, communist regimes were established in South Yemen and Congo-Brazzaville. China exploded its first hydrogen bomb. Under President Richard Nixon, a Marxist regime was established in Benin, providing the first serious resistance any American president had put up to communist advances. South Vietnam was saved from communism for another few years. Under President Gerald Ford, the Imperial Congress, empowered by Watergate, turned its back on our allies in Southeast Asia. South Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos fell to communism. Communist regimes were also established in Guinea-Bissau, Ethiopia, Angola, and Mozambique. In Cambodia, Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot murdered between 1 million to 4 million out of a population of 7 million. Under President Jimmy Carter, there wasn't much territory left for the Soviets to conquer, but Carter did what he could to help. Soviet-backed Marxists came to power in Nicaragua, the Seychelles, and Grenada. The Soviet army invaded Afghanistan. Carter lifted the ban on travel to Cuba and North Korea. With his impeccable sense of timing, Carter gave a speech on May 22, 1977, exhorting Americans to abandon their inordinate fear of communism. Days later, Cuba dispatched a military force to Ethiopia. Under President Ronald Reagan, for the first time since the Russian Revolution, communist countries began to become free. Not one country fell to communism on Reagan's watch. 3 Soviet-backed regimes began to crumble, 1 was taken back outright, and by the end of his presidency, the USSR was negotiating the terms of its surrender. In 1980, months before Reagan would be elected president, Harvard Sovietologist Adam Ulam ruefully remarked that the Soviets' expanding empire could not be stopped unless faced with a power strong and determined enough to make Soviet foreign adventurism too risky and expensive. Under Ronald Reagan, America was that power. He came to the presidency audaciously announcing that the Soviet Union was an evil empire, whose last pages, even now, are being written. By the end of Reagan's second term, the last page had been written. Reagan had always known he could destroy the Soviet Union if he could only be given 2 terms in the White House. In 1964, Reagan backer Holmes Tuttle mapped out the future with mind-boggling accuracy. Reagan would run for governor of California in 1966, serve 2 terms, run for president in 1976, and by 1985, with God's grace, communism would be vanquished at home and abroad. As Edmund Morris writes, Reagan repaid Tuttle in kind and in full, only 4 years late. Had Reagan won the Republican primary in 1976,